I'm Steve Potter, and this is Cityscape. This weekend, Webster University's 8th Annual Audio Student Summit kicks off 3 days of audio seminars, workshops, and presentations designed for anyone interested in audio. On Saturday, recording engineer Ken Scott will be a featured speaker. He's worked with some of the biggest names in rock. And the title of his book says it all, Abbey Road to Ziggy Stardust. Ken Scott is here along with Barry Hufker, who is an audio professor at Webster University and chair of the Department of Audio, Aesthetics, and Technology. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
And first, Ken Scott, happy anniversary to you, because I think it was like 50 years ago, January, that you got your job in a little London studio, EMI, that, oh, they renamed it later.
Yeah, to Abbey Road. After 9 days of getting fed up with school, I suddenly start work at... that studio, and never knowing it was going to become the most famous recording studio in the world.
Yeah, I mean, 16, yep. You weren't done with high school, that's for sure.
Well, it was different over in England at that point. You could leave school at 15.
Oh, really?
It was very early. Education was out in the real world, basically, back then.
Were your parents on the same page with you?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, totally. They were... I knew what I wanted to do at 12 and a half, and they were with me all the way. I'd speak to people at the school, and you want to be what? Because no one knew what a recording engineer was back
then. I was going to say, if you said I wanted to be in the entertainment industry or if I wanted to be a singer, but you want to be an engineer?
Well, which is completely the wrong terminology, because the training at Abbey Road was very much... it was to do with the sound, not with the electronic side of things. And so... technologically, I'm stupid. I'm dumb. I know nothing about any of that. But I do know how to get a sound. And whether that can be called engineering or not, I don't know.
Hmm. I've got a lot of questions for you. Before we do that, though, Barry, give us a little background on this Audio Student Summit. I think you call it the Central Region, but it's part of a bigger operation.
Well, it's become a bigger operation. It started 8 years ago by the students at Webster University, and the idea was to create a mini national convention. There is a convention every year, the Audio Engineering Society, and it's in New York or it's in San Francisco. And so there's nothing in between, and we thought, let's have a convention strictly geared towards students. Let's focus on their needs, their wants, and let's make it special for them. So we did that 8 years ago, and it's blossomed, and we've been lucky to have wonderful guest speakers every year, and this year we're so lucky to have Ken. And so it's going to be tonight, Saturday, and Sunday. And it is for the public at large. You don't have to be a student. You can be anybody who's interested in audio.
Hmm. Ken, you've been in the business for 50 years, and we're talking about students.
Do you have to keep mentioning that? Please.
I'm sorry. You've been in the business a while. Yeah. And when we compare it to the kids that might be attending the seminar this weekend, the technology must be totally different.
Well, yes, the technology is different, but it can be used in the same way. It's down to the individual. When I started, we were recording on 4-track. We had to make decisions about how something was going to sound right from the beginning. We had to make decisions on which was the right guitar solo, which was the right vocal take. You couldn't have lots of playlists and pick between lots of things. When I record these days, I tend to use Pro Tools as a regular tape machine. I make decisions up front. I don't finish up with 51 guitar solos, leaving it to someone to make the decision later on. It's how we use technology that needs to be adjusted, not the technology itself.
Right. These days, I'm not going to name any names, but some people in the pop world, I wonder if they even sound like what I'm hearing on the radio, if they can even sound like that in person.
If you're referring to someone like Justin Bieber or Britney Spears, one of the things I'm doing in one of my talks is playing some of their stuff to just show what really goes on.
Well, I theorize that I could probably be a star if someone just got me in the studio, not because I'm talented, but because the engineers are talented.
Well, you'd need to learn to dance. I think that's the priority these days. And that's always the excuse. Oh, they have to lip sync because they're dancing so much. Well, go back and look at what Tina Turner used to do, and she never lip synced.
How many people today do it the old-fashioned way that you approve of? Anybody?
Oh, I'm sure there are a lot. Yeah, of up and coming. But as soon as a major label gets hold of them, it's a whole different ballgame.
Hmm. Are you still active in the business at all?
Oh, as much as I can be, yeah.
Well, I think last year you relocated. You'd been in Los Angeles for a long time, and you moved to Nashville?
I did indeed, last August, and loving it.
Why did you decide to do that?
Fed up with L.A. I moved over there in 1976, and having the same weather every single day since 1976 to 2013, it was enough. And just the music scene there, it's awful these days. People go there to become famous, not to make good music. And so my wife is a nurse. I'm in the music business. Nashville seemed to make sense because two of the biggest businesses there are health and music.
Are you hooked on the show, Nashville?
I've never watched it.
No kidding. Really?
So, someone told me the other day that it's like Playboy, the way you used to say you bought it for the articles. Well, apparently with Nashville, people say they watch it for the music. Yeah.
It's more than that. I admit I'm sort of hooked. Well, Barry, talk a little bit about the seminar, the summit. In addition to Ken, what else is happening?
Well, there are workshops and seminars and equipment presentations. We've got Dr. Sean Olive coming, who is from Harman International. And Harman International kind of owns every audio company there is. And he's also president of the Audio Engineering Society. We've got a lot of famous people who are going to talk about live sound and music recording and church sound and acoustics and how to mic things and how to succeed in the business. The cost is $35. We throw in lunch on Saturday and Sunday and breakfast. Holy cow. And, you know, it's just nonstop audio for 3 days beginning this evening.
That's Barry Huffger of Webster University. We're also talking to recording engineer and producer Ken Scott, who's going to be a part of this summit this weekend. In fact, on Saturday evening, early evening, late afternoon, 5 o'clock is the time. Barry, just talk for a second about Ken.
Okay.
The people that he's talked with. I refer to it, the name of his book, Abbey Road to Ziggy Stardust.
Right.
Well, there's a lot in between that, too.
Yeah.
Some of the people he's worked with, what impresses you?
Oh, my God. How can you not be impressed with everything he's done? You know, I mean, he's going to sit here and be embarrassed, and I don't care. You know, this is a man who is one of the people, when you talk about who has created the soundtrack to your life, this is one of the people who have done that. And, you know, when you look at his discography, you just go, oh, my God, you know, oh, my God. And, you know, you listen to the radio all the time and there's hit after hit.
Well, reel off some of those that Ken is too modest to mention.
Oh, my God. All right. Now I'm going to be embarrassed because I'm going to forget people. So, Ken, you're going to have to forgive me or you're going to have to jump in.
Well, there's the Beatles. There's Elton
Absolutely
John.
Absolutely the Beatles, Elton John and David Bowie and Supertramp and the Mahavishnu Orchestra and Stanley Clark. And now you've got to jump in because
Lou Reed, okay. America, Jeff Beck, Pink Floyd,
Devo. Didn't one
Tubes.
Of them just pass away?
Yes,
the drummer.
And not just rock groups either. People like Johnny Mathis and Judy Garland.
Well, yeah, I did those as a second engineer, just as an assistant engineer. So I was just there watching more than anything for those. I never actually pushed up any faders or anything to record them.
Okay, so it all started back in London when you were a teenager and you started working at the studios. It became Abbey Road. So that was like 1964. So I'm trying to think back. Where were the Beatles hadn't been on Ed Sullivan by then.
No.
Right. So where were they?
They were huge in England and Europe, but hadn't broken here yet. It was a short time. I started working there a short time before they started to record A Hard Day's Night. Within, I think it was 2 weeks of my being in the tape library, which was where I started, I had in my hand a tape box. Now, I was a huge Beatles fan, and I had in my hand a tape box, and it was from Paris, Pathé Marconi, the EMI equivalent in Paris. And there it is, the Beatles, and there's some German versions of a couple of their previous hits. But then at the bottom, there's a song called Can't Buy Me Love.
Mm.
Oh, my God, no one's heard this song, and I've got the tape in my hands. And it was amazing. And then a couple of weeks later, as walking along the corridor carrying some tapes from one studio to another. And there are the two Georges walking towards me, Harrison and Martin. And I just wanted to scream like the girls outside. Luckily didn't, but it was amazing.
As an engineer, as someone that, you know, works in the studio like you do, maybe it's different depending on the artist, but how well do you get to know the artist as people? Necessarily, do you?
Oh, at times, yeah. I look at it very much like making a movie. You spend a lot of time together. You get to know them very well for that period, but then it's suddenly all over, unless it's a James Bond movie when you come back again and again and again. But you get to know some of their peccadilloes and things that they don't like.
We have a question from a staff member here who's a little bit involved in the business, Greg. And he wants to know, on which Pink Floyd albums were you an engineer or producer? And how do you put your stamp on the music that you record?
Answer to the first. I did the last single with Syd Barrett, which was Apples and Oranges and Paintbox. So it wasn't on an album originally, and I started the next album where Dave Gilmour was a member of the band, and I can't remember the name of that album. I know there was a track called Corporal Clegg, whatever that album was. Now, I only ever remember doing one session for that particular album, but I have been shown paperwork that shows I did a lot more. But
you know, it's funny you say that. You've had a long career, and I read something, I can't remember exactly what it was, but you were talking about how you forget some of the sessions, because, I mean, how many thousands have you done?
Forget some. Forget most.
Yeah. Oh, it was the 60s and 70s.
Oh, no, not this. Believe me, it's not that at all. I was always straight. It was another day at the office. We never, ever considered that we would be talking about the sessions in 40 or 50 years' time. That was insane. If we were still talking about them in 2 or 3 years, that would have been amazing at that time. But 40 or 50 years... ridiculous.
You just referred there, Ken, to being straight, you know.
Yeah.
And that just makes me think that being in the music business, are there a lot of temptations for a young person? Was it hard to stay on the straight and narrow? And, I mean, that's a sincere question.
For me, it was remarkably easy. I just wasn't interested. I was interested in the music and doing my gig.
Because we know for some people, they go there.
Sure. No, absolutely. I was always more interested in being in the studio than being on the party scene. So I think my, being completely honest, my drug use was limited to about a week of smoking grass. And I had a couple of members of David Bowie's band, The Spiders, over one evening. And we were having dinner, and then joints were going round, and we were all sitting on the floor. And I remember I was told later that everything I said was in rhyme, which I'd love to do these days. I'd make a fantastic rapper if that happened. And then the other thing was, I was taught very early on by the Beatles to about Scotch and Coke, a drink called Scotch and Coke. Uh-huh. And that's always been my drink. So there we are, the joint's going round. I've got my Scotch and Coke by the side. And every time I had to get up, I would knock that Scotch and Coke everywhere. And I just thought, I can't go through this again. So I liked the Scotch and Coke too much. I gave up the grass as opposed to the drink. So.
Well, someone names come to mind now they're talking about this, who you worked with and who maybe sort of went down a different path than you, Phil Spector. And your paths certainly crossed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing how in hindsight you see things very differently about people. I did a session with him. It was a song that George Harrison had written called Try Some, Buy Some. And they had recorded the track at another studio and then came to me to do the vocal overdub and mix it. So we're upstairs in the mix room. Behind me is this small vocal overdub booth. And Ronnie Spector goes in there, and there's Phil, there's me, and there's George Harrison. So Phil pulls the button back. Okay, Ronnie, let's do a take. And we do a vocal take, beginning to end. And as soon as it's finished, Phil starts to tell the story. And after about 20 minutes, he says, okay, Ronnie, let's try another one. Give it a little more passion on the second chorus, can you? Okay, Phil. And do another take. As soon as it's finished, another 20-minute story. And Ronnie Spector was just standing there the entire time, not saying a word. Now, at the time, it just seemed, well, that's very strange. You'd expect with these long stories immediately after a take, she'd say, well, what do you think? Or something like that. Nothing. But then, of course, looking back, knowing what we now know, she was petrified. She wouldn't dare say a word.
I love the Wall of Sound and Phil Spector's work, but I know him mostly from later in life when he sort of came off as a freak.
Mm.
So when you know him, I mean, was he a nice guy?
Oh, he was fine. I had no problems with him. But you knew certain stories. You knew that he was banned from flying for a while because a plane was just about to take off and he went running up and down the aisle. It's going to crash. And they had to turn back and let him off.
I bet you've got million stories about a million people, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We won't go there, but maybe that's another book someday.
Maybe. But if I might say, one of the things that Barry was saying about yesterday, about tomorrow, it sounds very, very technical to me. And one of the things that I said up front for my giving a talk here is I'm not the slightest bit technical, so don't expect technical stuff from me. So I just want to say, any music fans that are out there that are interested in music, not just the technical side of it, please come along to my talk. You can come along just to that as well.
Right. And no, it's going to be a really great story time and a great retrospective.
And Barry, what about young people interested in this? Is this a good career field for young people today? Are there more jobs than when Ken started?
It's always been a challenging field. It's not for the faint of heart. It's for people who want to live a certain lifestyle, who are passionate about music, who have to learn something about audio or be involved in music no matter what. That's the thing. If you're looking for money, it's not going to happen. If you're looking for fame, probably not going to happen. It's for people who are passionate about music and audio and are willing to sort of sacrifice themselves for art.
Talk a little bit, Ken, about you were involved in what became what developed, I guess, into what we call jazz rock or progressive jazz. What was your role in that?
Well, that was one of those big why me type situations. I was over in France recording Honky Chateau, Elton John. And every dinner, Gus, the producer, Gus Dudgeon, and Elton would put on a record to play whilst we're all eating dinner. And they kept on putting this same record on. And it was by a band called Mahavishnu Orchestra. It was In a Mountain Flame. And I just, over conversations, I just got bits and pieces of this music and it sounded like complete rubbish to me. So I poo-pooed it, come back to England mixing, and I get a phone call from CBS that John McLaughlin and Mahavishnu Orchestra are coming over to England to do a TV show, and they'd like to meet with me about doing the next album. Well, of course, that's who Elton and Gus like. They sent me a copy of the record, and as soon as I sat down and listened to the record properly, I was absolutely blown away, and went and met with them at the BBC, and we hit it off, and we worked on the next album, Birds of Fire, and it just continued from there. From there, I did Billy Cobham, Stanley Clarke, Dixie Drakes, more work with Jeff Beck. An amazing turn in my career, and I have no idea where it came from.
Well, Ken Scott has some interesting stories to tell. He'll be doing that as part of Webster University's 8th Central Region Audio Student Summit. Ken Scott talking about his life, his career, and stories out of his book, I guess, Abbey Road to Ziggy Stardust. All this happens Saturday, 5 p.m. at Webster University's Community Music School Auditorium. If you'd like more information, go to stlpublicradio.org to the Cityscape page, and we'll have a link to Webster University. And so looking back on your career, I was going to ask you if you had a high point, but I would guess that's kind of hard to nail down.
It's a 50-year high point for me.
Yeah, see, this time you brought it up.
I know. Well, you brought it up so many times, I thought, what the hell?
What else? We just have a minute left, but what else might you hit on the talk tomorrow?
Well, I break down, and this might sound a little technical, but I break down multitracks on a couple of songs, famous songs, so that people can hear each individual instrument and how they work together, how we recorded it, and how it all works within the final process. It's stories. It's telling a little bit of history about what it was like for all of us, because there were so many of us at that period, from The Who, Rolling Stones, Beatles, Floyd, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, Elton, Bowie. we're all round about the same age, and we all grew up with the same kind of thing in England.
One final question for you.
Yes.
You have a big vinyl collection?
No, I don't have any.
I'm surprised.
I gave up on it. I've moved too many times.
It's just a lot of packing. Yeah. A lot of packing. I get it. Ken Scott, recording engineer and producer, tomorrow, 5 p.m. at Webster University. Thanks, Ken Scott, for dropping by and visiting.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Barry Hufker is here, too, from Webster University. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next week on Cityscape, we're going to talk about the Fox Charitable Foundation's Teen Talent Showcase. Then join Don Marsh Monday on St. Louis on the Air, when he'll talk about current issues pertaining to the law with a panel of legal experts. Cityscape is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, and Amanda Hunnickfort. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. Cityscape is made possible in part by the Arts and Education Council of Greater St. Louis, the Regional Arts Commission, and the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Cityscape is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. I'm Steve Potter, and hope you join us again next week.